I could always turn them down, said Jimmy, when this tale had been told. I could join the ranks of the permanently unemployed, or hey, I could go on being a kept man, like now. Joke, joke, don't kill me. Amanda was more silent than ever for the next few days. Then she told him she'd unblocked herself artistically. The next key word for the vulture sculpture had come to her. And what's that? Said Jimmy, trying to sound interested. She looked at him speculatively. Love, she said. A new you. Jimmy moved into the junior apartment provided for him in the A New You compound. Bedroom in an alcove, cramped kitchenette, reproduction 1950s furniture. As a dwelling place, it was only a small step up from his dorm room at Martha Graham, but at least there was less insect life. He discovered quite soon that, corporately speaking, he was a drudge and a helot. He was to cudgel his brains and spend 10-hour days wandering the labyrinths of the thesaurus and cranking out the verbiage. Then those above would grade his offerings, hand them back for revision, hand them back again. What we want is more, is less. That's not quite it. But with time he improved, whatever that meant. Cosmetic creams, workout equipment, jolt bars to build your musclescape into a breathtaking marvel of sculpted granite. Pills to make you fatter, thinner, hairier, balder, whiter, browner, blacker, yellower, sexier, and happier. It was his task to describe and extol, to present the vision of what, oh, so easily could come to be. Hope and fear, desire and revulsion, these were his stocks in trade. On these he rang his changes. Once in a while he'd make up a word. Tensicity. Fibrationous. Pheromonimal. But he never once got caught out. His proprietors liked those kinds of words in the small print on packages because they sounded scientific and had a convincing effect. He should have been pleased by his success with these verbal fabrications, but instead he was depressed by it. The memos that came from above telling him he'd done a good job meant nothing to him, because they'd been dictated by semi-literates. All they proved was that no one at A New You was capable of appreciating how clever he had been. He came to understand why serial killers sent helpful clues to the police. His social life was, for the first time in many years, a zero. He hadn't been stranded in such a sexual desert since he was 8. Amanda Payne shimmered in the past like a lost lagoon, its crocodiles for the moment forgotten. Why had he abandoned her so casually? Because he'd been looking forward to the next in the series. But the woman interviewer from A New You about whom he'd had such hopes was never seen again, and the other women he encountered, at the office or in the A New You bars, were either mean-minded, eye-the-target sharks, or so emotionally starved even Jimmy avoided them, as if they were quagmires. He was reduced to flirting with weight persons, and even they turned a cold shoulder. They'd seen fast-talking youngsters like him before. They knew he had no status. In the company cafe, he was a new boy, alone once more, starting over. He took to eating Soyo Boy burgers in the compound mall, or taking out a greasy box of Chicky Knobs nubbins to munch on while working overtime at his computer terminal. Every week there was a compound social barbecue, a comprehensive rat-fuck that all employees were expected to attend. These were dire occasions for Jimmy. He lacked the energy to work the crowd. He was fresh out of innocuous drivel. He loitered on the edges, gnawing on a burned soy dog and silently ripping apart everyone within eyesight. Saggy boobs, ran the thought balloon in his head. Bun-faced tofu brain, thumb-sucking poster boy, fridge woman, sell his granny, wobble-bummed bovine, bladder-headed jerk. He got the occasional email from his father, an e-birthday card perhaps, a few days later than his real birthday, something with dancing pigoons on it. As if he were still 11. Happy birthday, Jimmy. May all your dreams come true. Ramona would write him chatty, dutiful messages. No baby brother for him yet, she'd say, but they were still working on it. He did not wish to visualize the hormone-sodden, potion-ridden, gel-slathered details of such work. If nothing natural happened soon, she said, they'd try something else from one of the agencies. Infant aid, fotility, perfect babe, one of those. Things had changed a lot in the field since Jimmy came along. Came along, as if he hadn't actually been born, but had just sort of dropped by for a visit. She was doing her research, because of course they wanted the best for their money. Terrific, thought Jimmy. They'd have a few trial runs, and if the kids from those didn't measure up, they'd recycle them for the parts, until at last they got something that fit all their specs. Perfect in every way, not only a math whiz, but beautiful as the dawn. Then they'd load this hypothetical wonder kid up with their bloated expectations until the poor tyke burst under the strain. Jimmy didn't envy him. He envied him. Ramona invited Jimmy for the holidays, but he had no wish to go, so he pleaded overwork. Which was the truth, in a way, as he'd come to see his job as a challenge. How outrageous could he get in the realm of fatuous neologism and still achieve praise? After a while, he was granted a promotion. Then he could buy new toys. He got himself a better DVD player, a gym suit that cleaned itself overnight due to sweat-eating bacteria, a shirt that displayed email on its sleeve while giving him a little nudge every time he had a message, shoes that changed color to match his outfits, a talking toaster. Well, it was company. Jimmy, your toast is done. He upgraded to a better apartment. Now that he was climbing up the ladder, he found a woman, and then another one, and another one after that. He no longer thought of these women as girlfriends. Now they were lovers. They were all married, or the equivalent, looking for a chance to sneak around on their husbands or partners, to prove they were still young, or else to get even. Or else they were wounded and wanted consolation. Or they simply felt ignored. There was no reason he couldn't have several of them at once, as long as he was conscientious about his scheduling. At first he enjoyed the rushed, impromptu visits, the secrecy, the sound of Velcro ripped open in haste, the slow tumbling onto the floor. Though he'd figured out pretty soon that he was an extra for these lovers, not to be taken seriously, but instead to be treasured like some child's free gift dug out of a box of cereal. Colorful and delightful, but useless. The joker among the twos and threes they'd been dealt in their real lives. He was merely a pastime for them, as they were for him, though for them there was more at stake. A divorce, or a spate of non-routine violence, or at least a dollop of verbal uproar if they got caught. One good thing, they never told him to grow up. He suspected they kind of liked it that he hadn't. None of them wanted to leave their husbands and settle down with him, or to run away to the Plebelands with him, not that this was very possible anymore. The Plebelands were said to have become ultra-hazardous for those who didn't know their way around out there, and the Corps Corps security at the compound gates was tighter than ever. Garage. So this was the rest of his life. It felt like a party to which he'd been invited, but at an address he couldn't actually locate. Someone must be having fun at it, this life of his. Only right at the moment, it wasn't him. His body had always been easy to maintain, but now he had to work at it. If he skipped the gym, he'd develop flab overnight, where none was before. His energy level was sinking, and he had to watch his Jolt Bar intake. Too many steroids could shrink your dick, and though it said on the package that this problem had been fixed due to the addition of some unpronounceable patented compound, he'd written enough package copy not to believe this. His hair was getting sparser around the temples, despite the 6-week Anuu follicle regrowth course he'd done. He ought to have known it was a scam. He'd put together the ads for it. But they were such good ads, he'd convinced even himself. He found himself wondering what shape Craik's hairline was in. Craik had graduated early, done post-grad work, then written his own ticket. He was at Rejuvenescence now, one of the most powerful compounds of them all, and climbing fast. At first, the two of them had continued to keep in touch by email. Craik spoke vaguely of a special project he was doing, something white-hot. He'd been given carte blanche, he said. The sun shone out of his bum as far as the top brass were concerned. Jimmy should come and visit sometime, and he'd show him around. What was it that Jimmy was doing again? Jimmy countered with a suggestion that they play chess. Craik's next news was that Uncle Pete had died suddenly. Some virus. Whatever it was had gone through him like shit through a goose. It was like watching pink sorbet on a barbecue. Instant meltdown. Sabotage was suspected, but nothing had been proved. "Were you there?" asked Jimmy. in a manner of speaking, said Craig. Jimmy pondered this. Then he asked if anyone else had caught the virus. Craig said no. As time went by, the intervals between their messages became longer and longer. The thread connecting them stretched thinner. What did they have to say to each other? Jimmy's word-surf job was surely one that Craig would despise, though affably, and Craig's pursuits might not be something Jimmy could understand anymore. He realized he was thinking of Craig as someone he used to know. Increasingly, he was restless. Even sex was no longer what it had once been, though he was still as addicted to it as ever. He felt jerked around by his own dick, as if the rest of him was merely an inconsequential knob that happened to be attached to one end of it. Maybe the thing would be happier if left to roam around on its own. On the evenings when none of his lovers had managed to lie to their husbands or equivalents well enough to spend time with him, he might go to a movie at the mall, just to convince himself he was part of a group of other people. Or he'd watch the news. More plagues, more famines, more floods, more insect or microbe or small mammal outbreaks, more droughts, more chicken-shit boy soldier wars in distant countries. Why was everything so much like itself? There were the usual political assassinations out there in the plebs, the usual strange accidents, the unexplained disappearances. Or there were sex scandals. Sex scandals always got the newscasters excited. For a while it was sports coaches and little boys. Then there was a wave of adolescent girls found locked in garages. These girls were said, by those who had done the locking, to be working as maids, and to have been brought from their squalid countries of origin for their own good. Being locked in the garage was for the protection of these girls, said the men. Respectable men, accountants, lawyers, merchants dealing in patio furniture, who were dragged into court to defend themselves. Frequently their wives backed them up. These girls, said the wives, had been practically adopted, and were treated almost like one of the family. Jimmy loved those two words. Practically. Almost. The girls themselves told other stories, not all of them credible. They'd been drugged, said some. They'd been made to perform obscene contortions in unlikely venues, such as pet shops. They'd been rowed across the Pacific Ocean on rubber rafts. They'd been smuggled in container ships, hidden in mounds of soy products. They'd been made to commit sacrilegious acts involving reptiles. On the other hand, some of these girls seemed content with their situations. The garages were nice, they said, better than what they'd had at home. The meals were regular. The work wasn't too hard. It was true they weren't paid, and they couldn't go out anywhere, but there was nothing different or surprising to them about that. One of these girls, found locked in a garage in San Francisco at the home of a prosperous pharmacist, said she used to be in movies, but was glad she'd been sold to her mister, who had seen her on the net and felt sorry for her, and had come in person to fetch her and had paid a lot of cash to rescue her, and had flown with her on a plane across the ocean and had promised to send her to school once her English was good enough. She refused to say anything negative about the man. She appeared to be simple, truthful, and sincere. When asked why the garage was locked, she said it was so nobody bad could get in. When asked what she did in there, she said she studied English and watched TV. When asked how she felt about her captor, she said she would always be grateful to him. The prosecution failed to shake her testimony, and the guy got off scot-free, although he was ordered to send her to school immediately. She said she wanted to study child psychology. There was a close-up of her beautiful cat's face, her delicate smile. Jimmy thought he recognized her. He froze her image, then unpacked his old printout, the one from when he was 14. He'd kept it with him through all his moves, almost like a family photo, out of sight but never discarded, tucked in among his Martha Graham Academy transcripts. He compared the faces, but a lot of time had gone by since then. That girl, the 8-year-old in the printout, must be 17, 18, 19 by now, and the one from the news broadcast seemed a lot younger. But the look was the same. The same blend of innocence and contempt and understanding. It made him feel lightheaded, precariously balanced, as if he were standing on a cliff edge above a rock-filled gorge, and it would be dangerous for him to look down. Gripless. The Corpsichore had never lost sight of Jimmy. During his time at Martha Graham, they'd hauled him in regularly, 4 times a year, for what they called little talks. They'd ask him the same questions they'd already asked 12 times, just to see if they got the same answers. "I don't know" was the safest thing Jimmy could think of to say, which most of the time was accurate enough. After a while, they'd taken to showing him pictures. Stills from buttonhole snoop cameras or black and whites that looked as if they'd been pulled off the security video cams at plebland bank ATMs, or news channel footage of this or that, demonstrations, riots, executions. The game was to see if he recognized any of the faces. They'd have him wired up, so even if he pretended ignorance, they'd catch the spikes of neural electricity he wouldn't be able to control. He'd kept waiting for the happy cup of caper in Maryland to turn up. The one with his mother in it. He dreaded that. But it never showed. He hadn't received any foreign postcards for a long time. After he'd gone to work at a new U, the corpsman appeared to have forgotten about him. But no, they were just paying out the rope, seeing if he, or else the other side, meaning his mother, would use his new position, his dollop of extra freedom, to try to make contact again. After a year or so, there was the familiar knocking on the door. He always knew it was them, because they never used the intercom first. They must have had some kind of bypass, not to mention the door code. "Hello, Jimmy. How you doing? We just need to ask you a few questions, see if you can help us out a little here." "Sure, be glad to. Attaboy." And so it went. In what, his 5th year, at a new U, they finally hit pay dirt. He'd been looking at their pictures for a couple of hours by then. Shots of a boondocks war in some arid mountain range across the ocean, with close-ups of dead mercenaries, male and female. A bunch of aid workers getting mauled by the starving in one of those dusty famines far away. A row of heads on poles. That was in the ex-Argentine, said the Corps of Corps, though they didn't say whose heads they were or how they'd got onto the poles. Several women going through a supermarket checkout, all in sunglasses. 12 bodies sprawled on the floor after a raid on a God's Gardener's safe house. That outfit was outlawed now, and one of them sure looked a lot like his old roomie, the incendiary Bernice. He said so, being a good boy, and got a pat on the back, but obviously they'd known that already, because they weren't interested. He felt bad about Bernice. She'd been a nut and a nuisance, but she hadn't deserved to die like that. A lineup of mug shots from a Sacramento prison. The driver's license photo from a suicide car bomber, but if the car had blown up, how had they come by the license? 3 pantyless waitresses from a plebland no-touching nookie bar. They threw that in for fun, and it did cause a waver on the neural monitor, unnatural if it hadn't, and smiles and chuckles all round. A riot scene Jimmy recognized from a movie remake of Frankenstein. They always put in a few tricks like that to keep him on his toes. Then more mug shots. "Nope," said Jimmy. "Nope. Nope. Nothing." Then came what looked like a routine execution. No horseplay, no prisoners breaking free, no foul language. By this, Jimmy knew before he saw her that it was a woman they were erasing. Then came the figure in the loose gray prison clothing shuffling along, hair tied back, wrists handcuffed, the female guard to either side. The blindfold. Shooting by spray gun, it was going to be. No need for a firing squad. 1 spray gun would have done. But they kept the old custom, 5 in a row, so no single executioner need lose sleep over whose virtual bullet had killed first. Shooting was only for treason. Otherwise it was gas, or hanging, or the big brain frizz. A man's voice, words coming from outside the shot. The corpsman had the sound turned down because they wanted Jimmy to concentrate on the visuals, but it must have been an order because now the guards were taking off the blindfold. Pan to close-up. The woman was looking right at him, right out of the frame. A blue-eyed look. Direct, defiant, patient, wounded. But no tears. Then the sound came suddenly up. "Goodbye. Remember Killer. I love you. Don't let me down." No question, it was his mother. Jimmy was shocked by how old she'd become. Her skin was lined, her mouth withered. Was it the hard living she'd been doing on the run, or was it bad treatment? How long had she been in prison, in their grip? What had they been doing to her? "Wait," he wanted to yell, but that was that, Pullback shot, eyes covered again. Zap, zap, zap. Bad aim, red spurts. They almost took her head off. Long shot of her crumpling to the ground. Anything there, Jimmy? Nope. Sorry, nothing. How could she have foreseen he'd be looking? They must have picked up the heartbeat, the surge of energy. After a few neutral questions, want a coffee, need a leak? One of them said, so who was this killer? Killer, Jimmy said. He began to laugh. Killer was a skunk. There, he'd done it. Another betrayal. He couldn't help himself. Not a nice guy, eh? Some sort of biker? No, said Jimmy, laughing more. You don't get it. A skunk. A rackunk. An animal. He put his head down on his two fists, weeping with laughter. Why did she have to drag Killer into it? So he'd know it was really her, that's why. So he'd believe her. But what did she mean about letting her down? Sorry about that, son, said the older of the two corpsmen. We just had to be sure. It didn't occur to Jimmy to ask when the execution had taken place. Afterwards, he realized it might have been years ago. What if the whole thing was a fake? It could even have been digital, at least the shots, the spurts of blood, the falling down. Maybe his mother was still alive. Maybe she was even still at large. If so, what had he given away? The next few weeks were the worst he could remember. Too many things were coming back to him. Too much of what he'd lost, or, sadder, had never had in the first place. All that wasted time, and he didn't even know who'd wasted it. He was angry most days. At first he sought out his various lovers, but he was moody with them. He failed to be entertaining, and worse, he'd lost interest in the sex. He stopped answering their e-messages. Is anything wrong? Was it something I did? How can I help? And didn't return their calls. Explaining wasn't worth it. In earlier days, he would have made his mother's death into a psychodrama, harvested some sympathy, but that wasn't what he wanted now. What did he want? He went to the compound singles bar. No joy there. He already knew most of those women. He didn't need their neediness. He went back to internet porn, found it had lost its bloom. It was repetitive, mechanical, devoid of its earlier allure. He searched the web for the Hot Tot site, hoping that something familiar would help him to feel less isolated, but it was defunct. He was drinking alone now, at night, a bad sign. He shouldn't be doing that, it only depressed him, but he had to dull the pain. The pain of what? The pain of the raw, torn places, the damaged membranes where he'd wanged up against the great indifference of the universe. One big shark's mouth, the universe. Row after row of razor-sharp teeth. He knew he was faltering, trying to keep his footing. Everything in his life was temporary, ungrounded. Language itself had lost its solidity. It had become thin, contingent, slippery, a viscid film on which he was sliding around like an eyeball on a plate. An eyeball that could still see, however. That was the trouble. He remembered himself as carefree earlier in his youth. Carefree, thick-skinned, skipping light-footed over the surfaces, whistling in the dark, able to get through anything, turning a blind eye. Now he found himself wincing away. The smallest setbacks were major, a lost sock, a jammed electric toothbrush. Even the sunrise was blinding. He was being rubbed all over with sandpaper. Get a grip, he told himself. Get a handle on it. Put it behind you. Move forward. Make a new you. Such positive slogans. Such bland, inspirational promotions vomit. What he really wanted was revenge. But against whom, and for what? Even if he had the energy for it, even if he could focus and aim, such a thing would be less than useless. On the worst nights, he'd call up Alex the Parrot, long dead by then, but still walking and talking on the net, and watch him go through his paces. Handler. What color is the round ball, Alex? The round ball. Alex, head on side, thinking. Blue. Handler. Good boy. Alex. Corknut. Corknut. Handler. There you are. Then Alex would be given a cob of baby corn, which wasn't what he'd asked for. He'd asked for an almond. Seeing this would bring tears to Jimmy's eyes. Then he'd stay up too late, and once in bed he'd stare at the ceiling, telling over his lists of obsolete words for the comfort that was in them. Dibble. Aphasia. Breastplow. Enigma. Gat. If Alex the parrot were his, they'd be friends. They'd be brothers. He'd teach him more words. Nell. Kern. Alack. But there was no longer any comfort in the words. There was nothing in them. It no longer delighted Jimmy to possess these small collections of letters that other people had forgotten about. It was like having his own baby teeth in a box. At the edge of sleep, a procession would appear behind his eyes, moving out of the shadows to the left, crossing his field of vision. Young, slender girls with small hands, ribbons in their hair, bearing garlands of many-colored flowers. The field would be green, but it wasn't a pastoral scene. These were girls in danger, in need of rescue. There was something, a threatening presence, behind the trees. Or perhaps the danger was in him. Perhaps he was the danger, a fanged animal gazing out from the shadowy cave of the space inside his own skull. Or it might be the girls themselves that were dangerous. There was always that possibility. They could be a bait, a trap. He knew they were much older than they appeared to be, and much more powerful as well. Unlike himself, they had a ruthless wisdom. The girls were calm. They were grave and ceremonious. They'd look at him. They'd look into him. They would recognize and accept him, accept his darknesses. Then they would smile. Oh, honey, I know you. I see you. I know what you want. 11. Pigoons. Jimmy's in the kitchen of the house they lived in when he was 5, sitting at the table. It's lunchtime. In front of him on a plate is a round of bread, a flat peanut butter head with a gleaming jelly smile, raisins for teeth. This thing fills him with dread. Any minute now his mother will come into the room, but no, she won't. Her chair is empty. She must have made his lunch and left it for him. But where is she gone? Where is she? There's a scraping sound. It's coming from the wall. There's someone on the other side, digging a hole through, breaking in. He looks at that part of the wall below the clock with the different birds marking the hours. Hoot, 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 says the robin. He'd done that. He'd altered the clock. The owl says, caw, caw. The crow says, chirrup, chirrup. But that clock wasn't there when he was 5. They'd got it later. Something's wrong. The time's wrong. He can't tell what it is. He's paralyzed with fright. The plaster begins to crumble. And he wakes up. He hates these dreams. The present's bad enough without the past getting mixed into it. Live in the moment. He'd put that on a giveaway calendar once. Some fraudulent sex enhancement product for women. Why chain your body to the clock? You can break the shackles of time, and so on and so forth. The picture was of a woman with wings taking flight from a pile of dirty old wrinkled cloth, or possibly skin. So here it is then. The moment, this one, the one he's supposed to be living in. His head's on a hard surface. His body's crammed into a chair. He's one big spasm. He stretches, yelps with pain. It takes him a minute to place himself. Oh yes, the tornado, the gatehouse. All is quiet, no puffs of wind, no howling. Is it the same afternoon, or the night, or the next morning? There's light in the room, daylight. It's coming in through the window over the counter, the bulletproof window with the intercom, where once upon a time, long, long ago, you'd had to state your business. The slot for your micro-coded documents, the 24-hour video cam, the talking, smiley-faced box that would put you through the Q&A, the whole mechanism is literally shot to hell. Grenades, possibly. There's a lot of fallen rubble. The scraping continues. There's something in the corner of the room. He can't make it out at first. It looks like a skull. Then he sees it's a land crab, a rounded white-yellow shell as big as a shrunken head, with one giant pincer. It's enlarging a hole in the rubble. What the shit are you doing in here? He asks it. You're supposed to be outside, ruining the gardens. He throws the empty bourbon bottle at it, misses. The bottle shatters. That was a stupid thing to do. Now there's broken glass. The land crab whips around to face him, big pincer up, then backs into its half-dug hole where it sits, watching him. It must have come in here to escape the twister, just as he did. And now it can't find its way out. He unwinds himself from the chair, looking first for snakes and rats and any other thing he might not wish to step on. Then he drops the candle end and the matches into his plastic bag and walks carefully over to the doorway, leading into the front reception area. He pulls the door shut behind him. He doesn't want any crab attacks from the back. At the outer doorway, he pauses to reconnoiter. No animals about, apart from a trio of crows perched on the rampart. They exchange a few caws, of which he is probably the subject. The sky is the pearly gray pink of early morning, hardly a cloud in it. The landscape has been rearranged since yesterday. More pieces of detached metal sheeting than before, more uprooted trees. Leaves and torn fronds litter the muddy ground. If he sets out now, he'll have a good chance of making it to the central mall before mid-morning. Although his stomach is growling, he'll have to wait till he gets there to have breakfast. He wishes he had some cashews left, but there's only the Soyo Boy sardines, which he's saving as a last resort. The air is cool and fresh, the scent of crushed leaves luxurious after the dank, decaying smell of the gatehouse. He inhales with pleasure, then sets off in the direction of the mall. 3 blocks along, he stops. 7 pigoons have materialized from nowhere. They're staring at him, ears forward. Are they the same as yesterday's? As he watches, they begin to amble in his direction. They have something in mind, all right. He turns, heads back towards the gatehouse, quickens his pace. They're far enough away so he can run if he has to. He looks over his shoulder. They're trotting now. He speeds up, breaks into a jog. Then he spots another group, through the gateway up ahead, 8 or 9 of them, coming towards him across no man's land. They're almost at the main gate, cutting him off in that direction. It's as if they've had it planned, between the 2 groups, as if they'd known for some time that he was in the gatehouse, and have been waiting for him to come out, far enough out, so they can surround him. He reaches the gatehouse, goes through the doorway, pulls the door shut. It doesn't latch. The electronic lock is non-functional, of course. Of course, he shouts. They'll be able to lever it open, pry with their trotters or snouts. They were always escape artists, the pigoons. If they'd had fingers, they'd have ruled the world. He runs through the next doorway into the reception area, slams the door behind him. That lock's kaput as well, oh naturally. He shoves the desk he's just slept on up against the door, looks out through the bulletproof window. Here they come. They've nosed the door open. They're in the first room now, 20 or 30 of them, boars and sows, but the boars foremost, crowding in, grunting eagerly, snuffling at his footprints. Now one of them spots him through the window. More grunting. Now they're all looking up at him. What they see is his head, attached to what they know is a delicious meat pie just waiting to be opened up. The 2 biggest ones, 2 boars with, yes, sharp tusks, move side by side to the door, bumping it with their shoulders. Team players, the pigoons. There's a lot of muscle out there. If they can't push through the door, they'll wait him out. They'll take it in relays, some grazing outside, others watching. They can keep it up forever. They'll starve him out. They can smell him in there. Smell his flesh. Now he remembers to check for the land crab, but it's gone. It must have backed all the way into its burrow. That's what he needs, a burrow of his own. A burrow, a shell. Some pincers. So, he says out loud. What next? Honey, you're fucked. Radio. After an interval of blankness during which nothing at all occurs to him, Snowman gets up out of the chair. He can't remember having sat down in it, but he must have done. His guts are cramping. He must be really scared, though he doesn't feel it. He's quite calm. The door is moving in time to the pushing and thumping from the other side. It won't be long before the pigoons break through. He takes the flashlight out of his plastic bag, turns it on, goes back to the inner room where the 2 guys in the biosuits are lying on the floor. He shines all around. There are 3 closed doors. He must have seen him last night, but last night he wasn't trying to get out. Two of the doors don't move when he tries them. They must be locked somehow or blocked on the other side. The third one opens easily. There, like sudden hope, is a flight of stairs. Steep stairs. Pigoons, it occurs to him, have short legs and fat stomachs. The opposite of himself. He scrambles up the stairs so fast he trips on his flowered sheet. From behind him comes an excited grunting and squealing, and then a crash as the desk topples over. He emerges into a bright, oblong space. What is it? The watchtower, of course. He ought to have known that. There's a watchtower on either side of the main gate, and other towers all the way around the rampart wall. Inside the towers are the searchlights, the monitor video cams, the loudspeakers, the controls for locking the gates, the tear gas nozzles, the long-range spray guns. Yes, here are the screens. Here are the controls. Find the target, zero in on it, push the button. You never needed to see the actual results, the splatter and fizzle, not in the flesh. During the period of chaos, the guards probably fired on the crowd from up here while they still could, and while there was still a crowd. None of this high-tech stuff is working now, of course. He looks for manually operated backups. It would be fine to be able to mow down the pigoons from above, but no, there's nothing. Beside the wall of dead screens, there's a little window. From it, he has a bird's-eye view of the pigoons, the group of them that's posted outside the checkpoint cubicle door. They look at ease. If they were guys, they'd be having a smoke and shooting the shit. Alert, though. On the lookout. He pulls back. He doesn't want them to see him, see that he's up here. Not that they don't know already. They must have figured out by now that he went up the stairs. But do they also know they've got him trapped? Because there's no way out of here that he can see. He's in no immediate danger. They can't climb the stairs or they'd have done it by now. There's time to explore and regroup. Regroup. What an idea. There's only one of him. The guards must have taken catnaps up here, turn and turn about. There's a couple of standard-issue cots in a side room. Nobody in them, no bodies. Maybe the guards tried to get out of rejuvenescence just like everyone else. Maybe they too had hoped they could outrun contagion. One of the beds is made, the other not. A digital voice-operated alarm clock is still flashing beside the unmade bed. "What's the time?" he asks it, but he gets no answer. He'll have to reprogram the thing, set it to his own voice. The guys were well-equipped. Twin entertainment centers, with the screens, the players, the headphones attached. Clothes hanging on hooks, the standard off-duty tropicals. A used towel on the floor, ditto a sock. A dozen downloaded printouts on one of the night tables. A skinny girl wearing nothing but high-heeled sandals and standing on her head. A blonde dangling from a hook in the ceiling in some kind of black leather multiple fracture truss, blindfolded but with her mouth sagging open in a hit-me-again drool. A big woman with huge breast implants and wet red lipstick, bending over and sticking out her pierced tongue. Same old stuff. The guys must have left in a hurry. Maybe it's them downstairs, the ones in the biosuits. That would make sense. Nobody seems to have come up here, though. After the two of them left. Or if they did, there'd been nothing they'd wanted to take. In one of the night table drawers there's a pack of cigarettes, only a couple gone. Snowman taps one out, damp, but right now he'd smoke pocket fluff, and looks around for a way to light it. He has matches in his garbage bag, but where is it? He must have dropped it on the stairs in his rush to get up here. He goes back to the stairwell, looks down. There's the bag, all right. Four stairs from the bottom. He starts cautiously downward. As he's stretching out his hand, something lunges. He jumps up out of reach, watches while the pigoon slithers back, then launches itself again. Its eyes gleam in the half-light. He has the impression it's grinning. They were waiting for him, using the garbage bag as bait. They must have been able to tell there was something in it he'd want, that he'd come down to get. Cunning. So cunning. His legs are shaking by the time he reaches the top level again. Off the nap room is a small bathroom, with a real toilet in it. Just in time. Fear has homogenized his bowels. He takes a dump, There's paper, a small mercy, no need for leaves, and is about to flush when he reasons that the tank at the back must be full of water, and it's water he may need. He lifts the tank top. Sure enough, it's full. A mini oasis. The water is a reddish color, but it smells okay, so he sticks his head down and drinks like a dog. After all that adrenaline, he's parched. Now he feels better. No need to panic. No need to panic yet. In the kitchenette, he finds matches and lights the cigarette. After a couple of drags, he feels dizzy, but still it's wonderful. If you were 90 and you had the chance for one last fuck, but you knew it would kill you, would you still do it? Craig asked him once.
You bet, said Jimmy.
Addict, said Craig. Snowman finds himself humming as he goes through the kitchen cupboards. Chocolate in squares, real chocolate. A jar of instant coffee, ditto coffee whitener, ditto sugar. Shrimp paste for spreading on crackers, ersatz but edible. Cheese food in a tube, ditto mayo. Noodle soup with vegetables, chicken flavor. Crackers in a plastic snap top, a stash of Jolt bars. What a bonanza. He braces himself, then opens the refrigerator, betting on the fact that these guys wouldn't have kept too much real food in there, so the stench won't be too repulsive. Frozen meat gone bad in a melted freezer unit is the worst. He came across quite a lot of that in the early days of rummaging through the plebe lands. There's nothing too smelly, just a shriveled apple, an orange covered with gray fur. Two bottles of beer, unopened. Real beer. The bottles are brown, with thin retro necks. He opens a beer, downs half of it. Warm, but who cares? Then he sits down at the table and eats the shrimp paste, the crackers, the cheese food, and the mayo, finishing off with a spoonful of coffee powder mixed with whitener and sugar. He saves the noodle soup and the chocolate and the Jolt bars for later. In one of the cupboards, there's a wind-up radio. He can remember when those things started being doled out in case of tornadoes or floods or anything else that might disrupt the electronics. His parents had one when they were still his parents. He used to play with it on the sly. It had a handle that turned to recharge the batteries. It would run for half an hour. This one looks undamaged, so he cranks the thing up. He doesn't expect to hear anything, but expectation isn't the same as desire. White noise, more white noise, more white noise. He tries the AM bands, then the FM. Nothing. Just that sound, like the sound of starlight scratching its way through outer space. Then he tries the shortwave. He moves the dial slowly and carefully. Maybe there are other countries, distant countries, where the people may have escaped. New Zealand, Madagascar, Patagonia, places like that. They wouldn't have escaped, though. Or most of them wouldn't. Once it got started, the thing was airborne. Desire and fear were universal. Between them, they'd been the gravediggers. Oh, talk to me, he prays. Say something. Say anything. Suddenly, there's an answer. It's a voice. A human voice. Unfortunately, it's speaking some language that sounds like Russian. Snowman can't believe his ears. He's not the only one, then. Someone else has made it through, someone of his own species. Someone who knows how to work a shortwave transmitter. And if one, then likely others. But this one isn't much use to Snowman. He's too far away. Dickhead! He's forgotten about the CB function. That was what they'd been told to use in emergencies. If there's anyone close by, the CB is what they'd be doing. He turns the dial. Receive is what he'll try. Then faintly, a man's voice. Is anyone reading me? Anyone out there? Do you read me? Over? Snowman fumbles with the buttons. How to send? He's forgotten. Where is the fucker? I'm here! I'm here! He shouts. Back to receive. Nothing. Already he's having second thoughts. Was that too hasty of him? How does he know who's at the other end? Quite possibly no one he'd care to have lunch with. Still, he feels buoyant, elated almost. There are more possibilities now. Rampart. Snowman's been so entranced by the excitement, the food, the voices on the radio,
that he's forgotten about the cut on his foot. Now it's reminding him. There's a jabbing sensation like a thorn. He sits down at the kitchen table, pulls the foot up as high as he can to examine it. Looks like there's a sliver of bourbon bottle glass still in there. He picks and squeezes and wishes he had some tweezers or longer fingernails. Finally, he gets a grip on the tiny shard, then pulls. There's pain, but not much blood. Once he's got the glass piece out, he washes the cut with a little of the beer, then hobbles into the bathroom and rummages in the medicine cabinet. Nothing of use, apart from a tube of sunblock. No good for cuts. Some out-of-date antibiotic ointment, which he smears on the wound, and the dregs of a bottle of shaving lotion that smells like fake lemons. He pours that on, too, because there must be alcohol in it. Maybe he should hunt for some drain cleaner or something, but he doesn't want to go too far, fry the entire foot sole. He'll just have to cross his fingers, wish for luck. An infected foot would slow him right down. He shouldn't have neglected the cut for so long. The floor downstairs must be percolating with germs. In the evening, he watches the sunset through the narrow slit of the tower window. How glorious it must have been when all 10 of the video cam screens were on, and you could get the full panoramic view, turn up the color brightness, enhance the red tones, toke up, sit back, drift on cloud 9. As it is, the screens turn their blind eyes towards him, so he has to make do with the real thing. Just a slice of it, tangerine, then flamingo, then watered-down blood, then strawberry ice cream, off to the side of where the sun must be. In the fading pink light, the pigeons waiting for him down below look like miniature plastic figurines, bucolic replicas from a child's playbox. They have the rosy tint of innocence, as many things do at a distance. It's hard to imagine that they wish him ill. Night falls. He lies down on one of the cots in the bedroom, the bed that's made. Where I'm lying now, a dead man used to sleep, he thinks. He never saw it coming. He had no clue. Unlike Jimmy, who'd had clues, who ought to have seen but didn't. If I'd killed Craik earlier, thinks Snowman, would it have made any difference? The place is too hot and stuffy, though he's managed to pry the emergency air vents open. He can't get to sleep right away, so he lights one of the candles. It's in a tin container with a lid, survival supplies. You're supposed to be able to boil soup on those things, and smokes another cigarette. This time it doesn't make him so dizzy. Every habit he's ever had is still there in his body, lying dormant like flowers in the desert. Given the right conditions, all his old addictions would burst into full and luxuriant bloom. He thumbs through the sex site printouts. The women aren't his type. Too bulgy, too altered, too obvious. Too much leer and mascara. Too much cow-like tongue. Dismay is what he feels, not lust. Revision. Dismayed lust. How could you? He murmurs to himself, not for the first time, as he couples in his head with a rent-a-slut decked out in a red Chinese silk halter and 6-inch heels, a dragon tattooed on her bum. Oh, sweetie. In the small hot room he dreams. Again it's his mother. No, he never dreams about his mother, only about her absence. He's in the kitchen. Woof goes the wind in his ear, a door closing. On a hook her dressing gown is hanging, magenta, empty, frightening. He wakes with his heart pounding. He remembers now that after she'd left he'd put it on, that dressing gown. It still smelled of her, of the jasmine-based perfume she used to wear. He'd looked at himself in the mirror, his boy's head with its cool, practiced, fisheye stare topping a neck that led down into that swaddling of female-colored fabric. How much he'd hated her at that moment. He could hardly breathe. He'd been suffocating with hatred. Tears of hatred had been rolling down his cheeks. But he'd hugged his arms around himself all the same. Her arms. He set the alarm on the voice-operated digital clock for an hour before dawn, guessing when that must be. "Rise and shine," the clock says in a seductive female voice. "Rise and shine. Rise and shine. Stop," he says, and it stops. "Do you want music?" "No," he says, because although he's tempted to lie in bed and interact with the woman in the clock, it would be almost like a conversation. He has to get a move on today. How long has he been away from the shore, from the Krakers? He counts on his fingers. Day one, the hike to rejuvenescence, the twister. Day two, trapped by the Pigoons. This must be the third day, then. Outside the window there's a mouse-gray light. He pisses into the kitchen sink, splashes water onto his face from the toilet tank. He shouldn't have drunk that stuff yesterday without boiling it. He boils up a potful now, there's still gas for the propane burner, and washes his foot, a little red around the cut, but nothing to freak about, and makes himself a cup of instant coffee with lots of sugar and whitener. He chews up a three-fruit jolt bar, savoring the familiar taste of banana oil and sweetened varnish, and feels the energy surge. Somewhere in all the running around yesterday, he lost his water bottle, just as well considering what was in it. Bird dung, mosquito wrigglers, nematodes. He fills up an empty beer bottle with boiled water, then snaffles a standard-issue microfiber laundry bag from the bedroom, into which he packs the water, all the sugar he can find, and the half-dozen jolt bars. He rubs on sunblock and bags the rest of the tube, and puts on a lightweight khaki shirt. There's a pair of sunglasses, too, so he discards his old, single-eyed ones. He deliberates over a pair of shorts, but they're too big around the waist, and wouldn't protect the backs of his legs, so he hangs on to his flowered sheet, doubling it over, knotting it like a sarong. On second thought, he takes it off, and packs it into the laundry bag. It might snag on something while he's in transit. He can put it back on later. He replaces his lost aspirin and candles, and throws in 6 small boxes of matches and a paring knife, and his authentic replica Red Sox baseball cap. He wouldn't want to have that fall off during the Great Escape. There, not too heavy. Now to break out. He tries smashing the kitchen window. He could lower himself down onto the compound rampart with the bedsheet he's torn into strips and twisted, but no luck. The glass is attack-proof. The narrow window overlooking the gateway is out of the question, as even if he could get through it, there'd be a sheer drop into a herd of slavering Pigoons. There's a small window in the bathroom high up, but it too is on the Pigoon side. After 3 hours of painstaking labor, and with the aid of, initially, a kitchen step stool, a corkscrew, and a table knife, and ultimately, a hammer and a battery-operated screwdriver he found at the back of the utility closet, he manages to disassemble the emergency air vent and dislodge the mechanism inside it. The vent leads up like a chimney, then there's a bend to the side. He thinks he's skinny enough to fit through. Semi-starvation has its advantages, though if he gets stuck, he'll die an agonizing and also ludicrous death. Cooked in an air vent. Very funny. He ties one end of his improvised rope to a leg of the kitchen table. Happily it's bolted to the floor, and winds the rest around his waist. He attaches his bag of supplies to the end of a second rope. Holding his breath, he squeezes in, torques his body, wriggles. Lucky he's not a woman. The wide butt would foil him. No room to spare, but now his head's in the outside air. Then, with a twist, his shoulders. It's an 8-foot drop to the rampart. He'll have to go head first, hope the improvised rope will hold. A last push, a wrench as he's pulled up short, and he's dangling, askew. He grabs the rope, rights himself, unties the end around his waist, lowers himself hand over hand. Then he pulls the supply bag through. Nothing to it. Damn and shit. He's forgotten to bring the wind-up radio. Well, no going back. The rampart is 6 feet wide, with a wall on either side. Every 10 feet there's a pair of slits, not opposite each other but staggered, meant for observation, but useful too for the emplacement of last-ditch weaponry. The rampart is 20 feet high, 27 counting the walls. It runs all the way around the compound, punctuated at intervals by a watchtower, like the one he's just left. The compound is shaped like an oblong, and there are 5 other gates. He knows the plan, having studied it thoroughly during his days at Paradise, which is where he's going now. He can see the dome, rising up through the trees, shining like half a moon. His plan is to get what he needs out of there, then circle around via the rampart, or if conditions are right, he can cut across the compound space on level ground, and make his way out by a side gate. The sun is well up. He'd better hurry, or he'll fry. He'd like to show himself to the Pigoons, jeer at them, but he resists this impulse. They'd follow along beside the rampart, keep him from descending, so every time he reaches an observation slit, he crouches, holding himself below the sight line. At the third watchtower along, he pauses. Over the top of the rampart wall, he can see something white, grayish-white and cloud-like, but it's too low down to be a cloud. Also, it's the wrong shape. It's thin, like a wavering pillar. It must be near the seashore, a few miles north of the Craker encampment. At first he thinks it's mist, but mist doesn't rise in an isolated stem like that. It doesn't puff. No question now. It's smoke. The Crakers often have a fire going, but it's never a large one. It wouldn't make smoke like this. It could be a result of yesterday's storm, a lightning strike fire that was dampened by the rain and has begun smoldering again. Or it might be that the Crakers have disobeyed orders and have come looking for him and have built a signal fire to guide him home. That's unlikely. It isn't how they think. But if so, they're way off course. He eats half a Jolt bar, downs some water, continues along the rampart. He's limping a little now, conscious of his foot, but he can't stop and tend to it. He has to go as fast as he can. He needs that spray gun, and not just because of the Wolvogs and the Pigoons. From time to time he looks over his shoulder. The smoke is still there, just the one column of it. It hasn't spread. It keeps on rising. 12. Plebe Crawl. Snowman limps along the rampart towards the glassy white swell of the bubble dome, which is receding from him like a mirage. Because of his foot, he's making poor time, and around 11 o'clock the concrete gets too hot for him to walk on. He's got the sheet over his head, draped himself as much as possible, over his baseball cap and over the tropical shirt, but he could still burn, despite the sunblock and the 2 layers of cloth. He's grateful for his new 2-eyed sunglasses. He hunches down in the shade of the next watchtower to wait out the noon, sucks water from a bottle. After the worst of the glare and heat is past, after the daily thunderstorm has come and gone, he'll have maybe 3 hours to go. All things being equal, he can get there before nightfall. Heat pours down, bounces up off the concrete. He relaxes into it, breathes it in, feels the sweat trickling down, like millipedes walking on him. His eyes waver shut, the old films whir and crackle through his head. "What the fuck did he need me for?" he says. "Why didn't he leave me alone?" No point thinking about it, not in this heat, with his brain turning to melted cheese. Not melted cheese, better to avoid food images. To putty, to glue, to hair product, in cream form, in a tube. He once used that. He can picture its exact position on the shelf, lined up next to his razor. He'd liked neatness in a shelf. He has a sudden clear image of himself, freshly showered, running the cream hair product through his damp hair with his hands. In paradise, waiting for Oryx. He'd meant well, or at least he hadn't meant ill. He'd never wanted to hurt anyone, not seriously, not in real space-time. Fantasies didn't count. It was a Saturday. Jimmy was lying in bed. He was finding it hard to get up these days. He'd been late for work a couple of times in the past week, and added to the times before that and the times before that, it was going to be trouble for him soon. Not that he'd been out carousing, the reverse. He'd been avoiding human contact. The Anu-U higher-ups hadn't chewed him out yet. Probably they knew about his mother and her traitor's death. Well, of course they did, though it was the kind of deep, dark, open secret that was never mentioned in the compounds. Bad luck, evil eye, might be catching, best to act dumb, and so forth. Probably they were cutting him some slack. There was one good thing, anyway. Maybe now that they'd finally scratched his mother off their list, the corpsman would leave him alone. "Get it up, get it up, get it up," said his voice clock. It was pink, phallus-shaped, a cock clock, given to him as a joke by one of his lovers. He'd thought it was funny at the time, but this morning he found it insulting. That's all he was to her, to all of them, a mechanical joke. Nobody wanted to be sexless, but nobody wanted to be nothing but sex, Craik said once.
Oh, yes, siree, thought Jimmy. Another human conundrum.
What's the